Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Let's go. It's a wonderful Wednesday. I can't wait to get started. We've got a barn burner for you today, an amazing guest. Going to hand out the phone number right now, 888-914-9149. Save it on your mobile phone. Yep, got to program it in. 888-914-9149. That's the hotline. That is the toll-free studio line to talk to me for free on the Cale Clark Show. You can also email the program. It's a great place to send show ideas, comments, questions. Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can also find me on Twitter. At Cale Clark is my handle, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And we have a show account as well, at Cale Clark Show. Perhaps you saw me tweet about this show and who my guest is going to be. I'm going to introduce him to you in just a moment. One thing you can also do is send questions in on Twitter. I'm going to ask Jim and Patrick to monitor those accounts during the show, and we'll try to get those Twitter questions up if possible. So let me get right to it. My guest today spent 32 years in international government service. His assignments included serving as Canada's senior representative in Taiwan, acting as foreign and defense policy advisor to the prime minister, and directing the Afghanistan task force during Canada's Kandahar mission. And he closed his career as Canada's ambassador to the People's Republic of China. His book, Middle Power, Middle Kingdom, which is all about Canada-China relations in the 21st century, won the J.W. Defoe Prize in 2016. And from 2015 to 2018, he was also the president and vice chancellor of the University of St. Michael's College in Toronto. That might sound like an oxymoron. How can a university be a college? Maybe we can talk about that later. But the University of St. Michael's College in Toronto is one of the world's most esteemed Catholic universities. He and his wife, Janet, have been married for 43 years, are parents of three children. David Mulrooney is my guest today. David, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Great to be with you, Cale.
Fantastic. Well, David, I do like to start off with my guests by asking them a little bit about their superhero origin story, if you will. And I have to let everybody know that you were actually born in the same city as me, Halifax, Nova Scotia. So I know you're a good person. Santo Subito, you're a blue noser. But tell me about your upbringing, your early life, and maybe how your faith factored into that.
Sure. Born in Halifax because my father was in the Royal Canadian Navy. He was from Ottawa originally. My mom was from Toronto. But they had my older brother and me while my dad was serving in the Navy. And then they ultimately moved back to Toronto. And I grew up right downtown in St. Basil's Parish, which is on the grounds of the University of St. Michael's College.
That's right, yeah.
Where they work. And so I was trained by the Bazilian Fathers. I went to St. Mike's High School. I think it's true to say that it feeds people into the University of St. Michael's College and into the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's a great hockey school in Toronto. And then went to St. Mike's and had a real interest in working internationally and took the Foreign Service exam a couple of times and was lucky enough to get in and had a tremendous experience with Janet and with our kids. Our kids were born through all of those years. Aiden was a baby when we got to Korea. Kate was born while we were in Shanghai, and Sean was born in Hong Kong. And so they went to schools overseas and then back to schools in Canada off and on. And so it was a wonderful experience and an opportunity for me to make a contribution to Canadian life. And it's one of the things that continues to interest me. How can we ensure that young Catholics get to give their gift of service here in Canada? And that's something maybe we can talk about it later, that I think is increasingly difficult and worrisome to some. How can they serve authentically and faithfully? But I had that opportunity in the Canada I knew in my working years.
So you kind of, even when you were young, you kind of dreamed of being a public servant, it seems like.
Yes, I had a cousin, and she was sort of two generations older than me, who had worked in what was then called external affairs, and she'd gone to different places. She was an amazing person She cross-country skied in Ottawa into her late 70s, wow. Full of life. And she told me a lot about that work. And both my parents, and particularly my father, really valued public service and instilled in us a sense that it was a really worthy calling. And he'd grown up in Ottawa, and of course, he sort of lived and breathed it. So it was something I felt very strongly about. I had also thought about, I studied English at St. Mm-hmm. Mike's, and when I graduated, I thought maybe I'd gravitate into a career in journalism. And as a matter of fact, when I got the Foreign Service offer, I also had an offer from CBC Sports.
No kidding.
I've often wondered about the road not taken. But I'll tell you, one of the things that I tell young people now is, I learned through a number of assignments at school and in some jobs I had right after graduating, how to write quickly and through taking a lot of hard knocks, how to write accurately and how to meet deadlines. And after 32 years in the Foreign Service, brevity, writing in a concise manner and delivering it on time were still things that eluded a lot of people in Ottawa. Margaret Thatcher used to say that she sent someone a 10-page memorandum, and she apologized and said, if I'd had more time, I'd have sent it in one page. You know, the value of getting your message down and delivering it on time, there's nothing more important than that. So a career in the humanities where you learn to write is an important one.
Oh, yeah. I think writing is a lost art in all professions. I mean, even emails. I mean, some of the emails that people send, they're just ridiculous. Just poor punctuation and grammar. But having said that, by the way, I didn't know that about you, David. You're certainly a man after my own heart now, but wanting to be a sportscaster as well. That was kind of my dream growing up. And those who listen to the show on the regular know I do talk sports a lot. And it's good to know that you're a Leafs fan. Of course, that is the official hockey team of the Cale Clark Show. But speaking of writing, and speaking of writing with brevity, one place that you've got to do that, of course, is on Twitter. And you've got an excellent Twitter handle, at @David_Mulrooney. And Mulrooney is spelled M-U-L-R-O-N-E-Y, @David_Mulrooney. And you tweet a lot. You've got a great Twitter feed. And one of the things that you post a lot of links about, a lot of information on, is what's going on with China. And of course, being a former ambassador to China, you've shared a lot about how they have, I guess you could say, tentacles reaching into a lot of different countries, including in North America. What do you think, David, that people in North America, in the United States, and in Canada need to know right now about China?
Well, that it's a tremendously complicated partner. We've never had a partner like China that has a huge and growing economy and offers a lot of opportunities to companies, a lot of business prospects, is a key player in things like global health and the environment, et cetera. It's we have to deal with China. But it also poses and has posed for some time a threat to free societies through interference, attempts to coerce, to bully for smaller countries, mm-hmm. To align them to China's thinking. Now, for many years, China hid this. They had a policy under a former leader, a very wise and wily leader named Deng Xiaoping, who said, essentially, hide your capabilities, bide your time. And to get back into the world of sports, I thought of this as don't dance in the end zone, right? Don't draw attention to yourself. And for a while, about 20 years, from 1990 to close the first decade of this century, that was largely the way that China managed things. Although covertly, it was still working to influence diaspora groups, groups of Chinese, ethnic Chinese people who've settled around the world, to do what's called elite capture. That is to offer lucrative board memberships or contracts or free travel to people who shape opinion or have political influence in a lot of countries, always trying to shape policy to coerce or persuade people to adopt China's line. Now, as a diplomat, I encouraged people to understand Canada and I tried to advance Canadian interests, but I did it above board. I did it publicly and I did it in ways that are lawful. China does that above, they have an above board dimension through some of their diplomats, but they have a very, very active effort that is unseen, that is below the surface, that is clandestine, and that's really what we have to understand. It's a country that has two faces, two dimensions, and you need to understand both.
My guest is David Mulrooney, former Canadian ambassador to China, author of Middle Power, Middle Kingdom. If you have a question for David about international relations, about what's going on with China, you can call in right now, 888-914-9149. One of the things that you've talked about, David, is influence of elections. And you recently alluded to a recent case in the U.S. where China was influencing one of the candidates. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we're seeing cases where what China does is works through diaspora communities and Chinese language media to encourage stories either directly or by leaning on advertisers who then get to the media outlet and to its journalists to suggest that people they like are all good and that people they see as a threat to China are doing things that China just makes up that are not true. And this appears not just to have happened. It happened recently in the United States. The United States took decisive action. There were a number of cases, including one where there was actual assault of a politician in the United States. But in Canada, we've seen it where it is the allegation, and it appears to have some serious merit, is that they took action against a number of conservative candidates because of the position the Conservative Party in Canada took, which they considered to be anti-China. And if you look at statistically the way candidates performed in the previous election against the most recent election, it would seem that in ridings where there was a large Chinese diaspora population, there was some impact. So this is really serious when you get down to the level of your politics and the idea that China may be trying to influence things. And what worries me is that while the Americans have taken interest in this, the Australians have taken interest. They had a politician who was making pro-China speeches, and then it turns out had a financial interest, was being essentially appears to have been paid to say these things. That's something you can't ignore. But I still worry that we are ignoring it. And what's at stake is there are economic interests at stake. There are secrets that China can spirit out of the country through various forms of espionage. But it comes down to our autonomy and our sovereignty as a country. And if we think that may be far-fetched or it hasn't happened yet, if you look back at what happened when the RCMP detained Madam Meng Wanzhou, who was the chief financial officer of Huawei, they held her at the request of the United States, who asked us to commence an extradition process because she was wanted in the U.S. because of allegations about some of the business dealings of Huawei and of Madam Meng herself. And we did this. China then beat two Canadians completely bogus, made-up charges, treated them abominably, put them essentially in 24/7 surveillance with the lights on, good cop, bad cop, no access to friends, family, no consular visits from the Canadian embassy for months and months and months, and then into a big, crowded, dirty Chinese jail cell to put pressure on us. And what they were trying to do, in addition to free their citizen, who was kind of a princess in Chinese society, she was the daughter of the founder of Huawei. What they were also trying to do was say, Canada, in future, don't even think about honoring your extradition obligations to the United States if somebody who is important to us is concerned. We're going to limit your ability to do that, and we're going to limit your autonomy. This is one of the fundamental things that a state can decide for itself. And what really worried me, Cale, is that we began to hear through this debate, and you'll recall it was a lengthy, people taking both sides for many, many months. We heard a number of very prominent Canadians, people who held or had held very important positions, say that we should capitulate and return Ms. Meng to China and forget about our obligations to the United States. And I thought, this is what it must feel like to be in a country before it becomes a vassal state.
Wow.
There's a kind of a moral fatigue where it's just too darn hard to hold up our obligations. And, you know, Canada wasn't always a country like that. We, you know, and it's a bit of a cliche to say we punched above our weight, but we were the Third Army of D-Day, right? Mm-hmm. We stood up and we played a major role during both world wars and for a considerable time after the wars. And there was a time when we would not have ever considered folding on something like this. So I worried, of course, I was shocked and outraged by what happened, but I was also worried by the Canadian reaction that was certainly far from robust. And I think we need to consider this carefully.
That's well said. My guest is David Mulrooney, former ambassador to China. I'll have much, much more with David in just a moment. We've got to take a quick break on the Cale Clark Show. If you have a question for him, you can call in right now, 888-914-9149. We're going to talk about religious freedom on the other side of the break, including the role and, in many cases, the plight of the Catholic Church in China. We'll be right back, 888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, 888-914-9149. If you have a question for my guest, it's David Mulrooney, former Canadian ambassador to China, former president of St. Michael's College. And David, I wanted to talk to you a little bit, just before the break, we started to get into China and what you termed elite capture, this idea of influence that it tries to gain through buying people off, board positions, all kinds of things like that. One of the big questions, obviously, that comes up with respect to China time and again, it was front and center a few weeks ago during the Winter Olympics in Beijing, was the question of religious freedom. Obviously, one of the reasons in my books that the ratings were way, way down for the Olympics was because I think it had very little to do with the time change, the time difference, you know, whether it's tape delay in the United States. A lot of it was, quite frankly, about the dissatisfaction, the disapproval in the United States with respect to persecution, human rights abuses, especially what's going on in China, the plight of Uyghur Muslims in the various concentration camps that exist there, all the horrific reports that we're hearing. Can you speak to this reality, and what, if anything, can the rest of the world do to put a stop to this?
Well, you're right. It is horrific. One of the things that's important to remember about China is, in many ways, it's the last of the empires. China was around when Greece was flourishing, when Rome was flourishing. Mm-hmm. It was had an imperial presence when ancient Egypt was in power. And it still exists. It has changed remarkably, and its governance is different, but it is still essentially the same state. And it has, over time, acquired many other nations, peoples, and communities, including a large, large Muslim population, about the size of the province of Ontario, but 13 to 14 million people in the far west, in an area that's the size of the U.S. Southwest. Mm. And then also what for many centuries was independent, the Kingdom of Tibet, has been brought into this Chinese world. And the Chinese policy for many, many years has been total and brutal assimilation, first by essentially driving the Dalai Lama out of Tibet, destroying the temples, the mm-hmm. shrines, the religious artifact, and the culture of the Tibetan people, and now doing the same thing in Xinjiang in the West with the Uyghur Muslims. And that has included building, as you say, concentration camps for at least a million people, if not more. It includes 24/7 surveillance. It includes, from shocking testimony, forced abortion and forced contraception in Uyghur society, which previously had been allowed to avoid the one-child policy and in consonant with Muslim values and Muslim life, to have large and happy families. Maybe the most sinister thing that the Chinese state is doing, the party is doing, is actually infiltrating the family itself. So if a husband is imprisoned, they will put a Chinese man, a party representative, in the family to observe, but also to kind of sow discord and suspicion and to undermine the family structure. And this is happening. It's an outrage to faithful Muslims. And it's happening in many, many places. And what's really shocking about it is it's something we've seen before in China, but through its use of technology, it's also the tyranny of tomorrow. This is something that China is testing in Xinjiang that other dictatorships will follow. So it was shocking indeed that they got the Winter Games. And I think you're absolutely right. People were disgusted by it as China put on a happy face. I was ashamed, to be honest, that Canada participated. I thought,
me too.
We saw this years out that this was going to happen, and we still, the Prime Minister, I think, came up with some insufficient excuses that as if the Olympic Committee was totally independent. He had no say in it. If he'd wanted to stop it, he could have. Most MPs declared it to be a genocide. And in 20 or 30 years, we'll look back and say, I wonder why we did that. Maybe we didn't know. We absolutely knew.
Absolutely. My guest is David Mulrooney, former Canadian ambassador to China and the former president of St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto. And by the way, there is a big storm right now in Toronto. So if there's a patron saint of cell phones, start praying. Hopefully the wind and the turbulence will not affect things too much. But
I have a statue of St. Michael just in the corner of my office. And I say the prayer to St. Michael every day.
I think you should.
I think I'm covered.
Yeah, let's get on it. And if you have a question for David, you can call in right now, 888-914-9149 is the number to call. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. And David, obviously, when we talk about religious freedom in China, the situation of the Catholic Church has to come up. For people who are listening who may not know the background here, can you explain to people the difference between what's known as the Patriotic Church in China and also the Underground Church and what the current situation is there?
Sure. The Catholic Church in China has pretty deep roots. Christians were exploring Western China 1,000 years ago. The church came in with Portuguese explorers and missionaries 500 years ago or so, roughly as the Jesuits were exploring from New France into the West, into Ontario, just as for example, the mission of Huronia was being started. Matteo Ricci, the great Jesuit,
yes,
was entering China. And you had Catholic enclaves tended to be where Catholic countries had a presence in China, and there were also a lot of Protestant enclaves as well. And that lasted up until the establishment of the People's Republic, the victory of the communists in the Civil War in 1949. And the communists allowed the churches and lots of foreign missionaries, including Canadian missionaries, to stay on for a couple of years, but then they began to crack down. And the reality is that they saw and have always seen religion, and the Catholic Church in particular, as an enemy, as the old enemy. And they made it very clear that missionaries would have to leave or face persecution. I was just with a bunch of Vincentian priests down in the United States, because my pastor, a pastor I knew in Taiwan and in Beijing, was a Vincentian, and their story is harrowing, but tremendously heroic. So they either imprisoned the missionaries or forced them out, and then they said to all the Protestants, you no longer have your denominations. You don't have Anglicans and Methodists and Presbyterians. We're going to put you into one church that will be controlled by the state.
Wow.
And you Catholics are different. Part of it is in Chinese, the word, the Jesuits created the word for Catholicism, Tianju Jiao, followers of the Holy Way. And the Protestants, the Chinese themselves said, okay, if you are these followers of the Holy Way, who are these other people, these Protestant people? And they took the name Jidu Jiao, the followers of Jesus. I think they got the better name, but that meant that caused great confusion in China. And so I'd sometimes get asked, are you a Catholic or a Christian?
Interesting.
I had to do a little bit of explaining. So they said that they put them into these two government-controlled groups. And for faithful Catholics, this, of course, was anathema. And they went underground and formed an underground church. And their hero, and someone I find tremendously inspiring, was the Bishop of Shanghai, Ignatius Kung. And when the time came to create this underground church, and he and others resisted, he was taken to a sports stadium full of people, and the idea was to humiliate him. They put a microphone in front of him and asked him, expected him to denounce the church and to sign on with the patriotic church. And what he said instead was, "Long live Christ the King." And for that, he spent 30 years in prison. And when I first served in China in the mid-1980s, I heard that he had been released from prison and was under a form of house arrest at a seminary near Shanghai. And I called and said, "Could I go see him?" And they said, "Yes." And I went and I met with him. And it was one of the times in my life when I thought, I'm in the presence of a saint.
Wow.
He was a remarkable man. And where we are now is, you know, the Vatican and Pope Francis is leading this, but Pope Benedict, of course, thought about these things too. And
he did. Yeah.
Pope Benedict wrote a wonderful letter to Chinese Catholics, and he said, this situation where we have a state-controlled church and an underground church, there are reasons for it, but it is ultimately unnatural, and it is much better for the church to exist openly, and it's much healthier and better for Catholics. It removes this cause of suffering and this threat. But he said, this can only be done if the state respects the freedom of the church. It can be regularized, and we need goodwill, and we need to heal these divisions, but not by betraying the magisterium, not by turning our back on what the church stands for. And that the Chinese didn't think much of that advice, the state, the party. And in the meantime, as you know, China was growing in confidence post the economic downturn of 2008-2009. China weathered the storm very well. Everyone was praising China for its policies. They cracked down even harder on the church, to the extent that when Pope Francis has tried to address this, he sent his diplomats to Beijing. But I think they have been less focused on preserving things that are not negotiable. And when you negotiate in diplomacy, you absolutely have to understand your counterpart. You cannot negotiate according to what you wish was true. You've got to deal with the world as it is. So I don't think that they have seen their counterparts. I don't think the Vatican diplomats, who are trying to regularize relations and with the very laudable aim of allowing the church to exist above ground, I don't think they have acknowledged or accepted the fact of this deep antipathy that the party feels to the church, and that it can, and the fact that the party cannot be trusted. So we're going into this negotiation without a clear sense of who's on the other side. And the result is, what does China want out of this? They want to destroy the underground church. They want to turn the church into a state-controlled NGO that is bloodless and that enshrines the teachings of the party, that elevates the party above the church, above the Pope, and that it, in fact, even incorporates some of the iconography of the party, the pictures of leader Xi Jinping and party signs and slogans. And it's a really, really worrying state of affairs. And what I think is most missing is what Chinese people got from Cardinal Kung. The first job of the church and its emissaries is to give heroic witness,
right,
to the gospel and to the sacred heart, to the heart of the church, and to Christ himself, Christ the King. And that's not happening. That's not happening. Chinese people are not going to, Chinese Catholics are not impressed by some diplomatic deal. They're impressed by witness. They're impressed. They've endured decades of oppression, and nobody wants that to continue. But at the same time, nobody wants that endurance to be for nothing. And so it's a very worrying state of affairs, I think, based on maybe muddled diplomacy. Much better no deal than a bad deal.
Perhaps some naivete on the part of Vatican officials in terms of dealing with China, and that there is a tremendous problem, of course, with the Patriotic Church and the state appointing their own bishops without Vatican approval. And it's not just Catholics as well that are suffering. Many Protestant Christians, I've heard a lot of stories I spent about 10 years outside of the church in the Protestant world, and I met some missionaries in China, some Chinese pastors, Protestant ministers who also spent a lot of time in prison camps, and their stories are so inspirational. And again, we have to separate the Communist Party from the people of China who are, we need to pray for them. We need to pray for Christians and, of course, the Catholic Church in China. My guest is David Mulrooney, former ambassador to China. We're going to take a quick break right now. The phone lines are really lit up. I know you guys have a lot of questions for David, so we're going to get back to this in just a moment. Quick break on the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. We'll be back with your questions after this.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. 888-914-9149 is the number to call if you have a question for my guest, David Mulrooney, former Canadian ambassador to China, and of course, the president of St. Michael's University College as well. He joins me from his home in Toronto. And just before we get back to David, I want to remind you all that you can join us on Friday. Father Rocky and Drew Mariani are going to anchor our live coverage of what promises to be an absolutely historic day at the Vatican, beginning at 11 a.m. Central. Going to bring you live coverage as Pope Francis leads, of course, the act of consecration of Russia and Ukraine to the Immaculate Heart of Mary. There's also going to be video coverage if you're watching on our digital channels. Wherever you may be on Friday, just take a moment, join the Holy Father, along with bishops and faithful from all over the world, offering a prayer for peace. Put Relevant Radio on your calendar so we can bring you this important event for our church and the world. And once again, my guest today on the Cale Clark Show is David Mulrooney. And speaking of Russia and Ukraine, just before we get to our phone calls, I do have to ask you about this. A lot of people are talking about the position of China with respect to Russia. Obviously, Presidents Xi and Putin are bros in a certain sense. They're BFFs in a certain way. They support one another. They backed up one another in the past. There's a lot of speculation and a lot of people saying this might be a key to ending the conflict. What is China going to do? Are they going to help send resources to Putin? Are they going to back up his action? Or maybe out of naked self-interest, there's so much trade and money to be made in Europe, in North America, so bad for the bottom line. They don't necessarily want to get on the wrong side of the Western world either. What is China's reaction, do you think, to all of this, David? And what lessons are they learning from what's going on today?
Well, I think what this shows and should remind us is how unready China is, how little confidence it has in itself. It's feeling very uncomfortable right now. China may be interested in global domination, but they're not interested in global leadership. They don't have any ideas. What they'd like to do is to be left alone and see this thing solve itself. If they can free ride on a solution and get credit for coming in to help without doing much, that would be okay. But yes, they are friends with the Russians. Not great friends. I mean, Russia and China have had an uneasy past. The former Soviet Union and China almost went to war. In fact, fought pitched battles in the late 60s. So they understand each other, but it's more the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
And Russia is also, you know, so much smaller now. The Russian economy is so much smaller. China is very interested in Russian resources in Siberia. And if they can have a kind of a bromance with Putin, that's fine. But he'll be diminished, however this ends. They're also, above all, interested in seeing the United States weakened, the alliance that stands with the United States weakened. And if that happens, that'll be just okay with China too. I think the result, more likely though, is that, and I fervently pray that this ends with a happy result for the Ukrainian people and in terms of the preservation of their freedom and their liberty. That would be a major defeat for China, because it would show that this kind of intervention, it would show how wrong this kind of intervention is. China has successfully tried to block coverage of the true horror of what Russia is doing in the Ukraine. So anything that sets back the Russian objectives ultimately hurts Xi Jinping, the leader of China, who has really been at the controls while this is happening. So China's very uncertain. The lesson they're taking from this, I think, is that if it's difficult for the Soviet army to attack across a land border, a country that is much smaller and should have been and was described as easy pickings for the Soviets, how easy is it going to be for China, or would it be for China, to attack across 100 sea miles, a country that is well-prepared and has strong support from not just the United States, but also Japan, and that is Taiwan. So I think there's some head-scratching going on in China as they look at how badly Russians have miscalculated and whether they should take some lessons from that.
Okay, that was one question I was going to ask you, whether you think that China might use the destruction that's being caused by the war in Ukraine to try to annex Taiwan. Obviously, I'm guessing you don't think that that's very likely.
I don't think it's likely, and in part because one of the things that's really surprising in this is how resolute the Japanese response has been. When the Russians annexed Crimea in 2014, I guess, the Japanese were largely silent. So the response from Japan in terms of economic sanctions has been strong, but also very strong indications of Japan's willingness to build up its military and to bear more of a burden. So I think China is having a lot to think about. And I mean, I think they've also been surprised by how resolute the global response has been. Yeah. And how pervasive the sanctions have been. And that's not a small issue for China, which it has a much stronger economy than that of Russia, but mm-hmm. It certainly has a lot to lose if serious sanctions start to take effect. We saw what happened in the Trump era when some of the things that he was doing certainly appeared to bring the Chinese to the negotiating table.
My guest is David Mulrooney, former ambassador to China from Canada. We have a question for you, David, and I'm going to go to the phones right now. Angelo is on the line from Clovis, California. Hello, Angelo. You are on with David Mulrooney.
Okay. I've just tuned in. I usually listen in the morning.
Okay.
I just picked up your broadcast this afternoon, and everybody's talking about what's going to come next with Russia. My concern is, and my question to you is, back in 2020, Chinese military was training in Canada for winter warfare. Now, is how much truth is there to that? And should we be concerned why Canada was allowing Chinese military to train on Canadian soil?
Thanks for that question, Angelo. Care to comment on that, David?
Yeah, that was a revelation that came out and embarrassed and appropriately embarrassed the government. And I think why that happened was Canada has, and this is, I mean, one of the things that I've tried to, I used my book for, and I try to use any of my public commentary for, to point out that Canada has yet to develop what I call a serious foreign policy, and one that takes full account of the risks in the world, who our friends are and who aren't our friends. And over the last 5 or 6 years, various parts of the Canadian government have been found and have embarrassed the government through their absolutely inexplicable partnerships with China on things like the development of a vaccine for COVID, on an award that was granted to a Chinese company to provide the security screening systems for our embassies abroad, and for this cooperation with the Canadian forces on winter warfare. And part of it is policy on autopilot. Part of it is just brainlessness on the part of people who are extending the invitations. But it comes down ultimately to a lack of leadership, to a compelling voice in Ottawa that says, before you do anything with China, stop, consult, think. And until that happens, I'm afraid, Angela, that we might see other errors like that. And it's embarrassing, but it's unfortunately a fact of life in Canada these days.
Thank you for that question, Angela. We're now going to go to Dee Dee, who's calling in Phoenix, Arizona. Hello, Dee Dee.
Hi. Mr. Mulrooney, just listening to your answer to the previous caller, I don't want to embarrass you, certainly. And I understand why. Perhaps Canada is still in a, you know, beginning stages, politically speaking. But my question is this, and pretty much it's somehow tied in with the previous caller. Again, I don't want to embarrass you. So what is Canada a member of NATO? And my other question is, I don't really know much about the history of Canada. And what is the current position vis-a-vis economic ties with China?
Okay, well, thanks, Didi. A lot of questions there. I don't think we can get into the history of Canada, but can you speak to maybe the NATO question, and especially what is David Canada's point of view on the Ukraine situation at the moment, and what, if anything, are they doing about it?
Sure, and let me do just touch on a couple of points of Canadian history, because I'm a proud Canadian. I mentioned earlier that Canada was one of the three armies of D-Day. The U.S. Army landed, the British Army landed, but Canada landed and fought its way up and out of Juneau Beach. At the end of the war, we had the third largest navy in the world and had played a great role in keeping the North Atlantic open. We also helped to build the Spitfires that won the Battle of Britain. And we fought in the Korean War as well, and I served in Korea and used to go with our military attaché, who'd been a young private, at the Battle of Kapyong, where the Canadians helped hold the back door of Seoul closed against a much larger Chinese force. It's a great story of Canadian wow. heroism and courage. We were a founding member of NATO, and so Canada has a wonderful past. It's the present that is maybe a little more problematic, and the issue is, and it's what I wrote my book about, that we've failed to adopt what I call a real grown-up foreign policy, in which we pay the full freight for our defense, we invest in our defense and the defense of our allies, where we think seriously about our economic health, about our energy security and the energy security of our allies. I do think that there's more of a discussion about this in Canada, that there is a note of realism that is being injected. It's not where I'd like it to be, but I think there's more China realism now than there has been in the past. And so I'm a cautious optimist that things will change. Canada is not the only country that has been unrealistic about China. Australia was for a long time, but they're more exposed than we are, and they're changing dramatically, and that's very encouraging. And I often use Australia as a good example for Canada to follow.
Okay, thank you very much for that question, Didi, and thanks for answering it. David Mulrooney, we do have an off-air caller who didn't want to come on the line, but did want to ask you, David, if you could elaborate a little bit about what actually happened to Meng Wanzhou. And maybe you could also throw in there something about how that company, Huawei, which is a telecommunications cellular network, they make smartphones as well, in case many people listening might not know who they are, how they were actually... They were kind of in the running to build out the 5G network in Canada, which many people thought might be a security backdoor for spying. Can you talk about that as well?
Yeah, the Meng Wanzhou case ended as a number of recent cases between involving Chinese citizens and the U.S. related to security concerns or related to concerns about foreign policy issues, and that is that there was an agreement reached between the U.S. Prosecutors and Meng Wanzhou, that there was a statement that she made that I think satisfied U.S. officials, and she was allowed to return to China. So that was always the way that people, the best way to solve this. Now, unfortunately, that took a really long time, and it took a long time because Meng Wanzhou, once she was apprehended in Canada and put under arrest, put together an incredible legal team, the top Canadian lawyers, top U.S. lawyers, and she used the Canadian system that gives individuals their day in court to defend herself and to stave off extradition. And that extended this process for many, many months while our two poor Canadians were languishing in jail. So it ended appropriately according to the rule of law, according to the rule of Canadian law and U.S. law, but the victims were two innocent Canadians who were apprehended by a cynical Chinese state, and they set up what I call a grotesque parody of the Canadian legal system and pretended to try them in a situation where there was nothing, they had done nothing wrong. So the system worked as it should ultimately, but with great pain to two young Canadians.
You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is David Mulrooney, former Canadian ambassador to China. And Dave, we've got about 5 minutes left or so, maybe slightly less. I want to ask you this, because you alluded to this at the beginning. Something that you talk about a lot is engaging the whole person in public service. If someone's listening to this program right now, maybe a young person, maybe somebody who's studying at a Catholic institution of higher learning like the one you used to serve, or even just a person of goodwill thinking, I've never really considered a career in public service before. Politicians are corrupt. The game is rigged. There's so much bias against people of faith in politics. What would you say to somebody listening right now who's maybe considering a path like you have pursued throughout your life?
First of all, I can't deny that I think it's more difficult. And the part of public service I was in was the professional public service. So I've never run for office, although I really respect those who have and who ultimately hold authority. When I joined the Canadian Public Service in 1981, there wasn't much daylight between my own views and values as a Catholic and the views and values of the Canadian state. I never thought that I would run into situations that made me feel uncomfortable as a Catholic. By the end of my time as ambassador, I was beginning to see instances where I felt uncomfortable. On one occasion, I refused to sign a project approval for the Canadian International Development Agency, which for American listeners is like USAID. It's our development agency, because I thought it was both immoral and wrong. Now, the agency found a way to get around my disapproval, but that to me also sent a signal that things were changing. In the 10 years that I've been out of government, things have changed further still. So I don't hide from young people of faith that it is the world is becoming a colder and less tolerant of religious views. But I also say that now more than ever, we need people with the integrity of their convictions and people who believe in the sanctity of human life and who believe that the world around us is intelligible and that it's our duty to understand and to know things, because ultimately what we're understanding and attempting to know is God himself. So one of the things I'm most interested now in as we deal with this is finding ways to create networks for people. I was always felt reassured when I found other public servants who shared my beliefs. So in Beijing, we had a group of people who put on masks for the international community in the embassy. We offered this to other religious groups as well, but it was the Catholics who really needed it. And we'd have, you know, at Easter, 200 Catholics from around the world who'd come to the embassy. And I haven't had a job where I had to do physical labor for a long time. But before Mass, because I lived on the embassy compound, I'd get over and I'd put out all the chairs, because it was a quiet time in my week, and I felt that my life was reconnecting. I was my professional self and my person. I knew I was coming home after this, my China posting, and I felt that I was reconnecting. So it's very important. Canada, as was the United States, was built in large part by the contributions of religious believers, and every Canadian city bears testimony to this. Canada can't afford to forego this gift, and so we've got to keep discussing this so that Canadian politicians are reminded of this, and young Canadians feel inspired to take up the challenge, although it's a greater challenge than when I began my career.
No doubt. Well, what an hour it's been. The book is Middle Power, Middle Kingdom. The Twitter account is @David_Mulrooney, Mulroney. The man, my guest himself, has been David Mulrooney, international man of mystery, I was going to say, but you've certainly made things a lot clearer for us. Thanks for taking the time. We'll definitely have you back again on The Cale Clark Show. Jim Shaper produced. Everybody go follow David Mulrooney on Twitter. Patrick Alok took your calls. We'll be back tomorrow on The Cale Clark Show. God bless you. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.